This is Barbara Foster reading about diabetes. Exercise for Beginners, Steps for Easing into a Routine by Bob Dinsmore. It's been said that exercise would be a wonder drug if they could put it in a bottle. It can prevent or even reverse heart disease and type 2 diabetes, fight depression, and slow the progression of arthritis. For people who don't exercise, the most obvious question is, how do I start? Check with your doctor. It's a good idea to check with your doctor and get a physical examination before you start a new exercise plan, especially if you're 45 years of age or older or have health problems such as heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, or anything that could increase your risk of injury. Your doctor may be able to suggest which activities are best for you and which ones to avoid. Most people can do some form of exercise regardless of any medical conditions they might have. Start off slowly. According to the Department of Health and Human Services Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans, people should get at least 30 minutes of moderate exercise, such as walking, most days of the week. But even if you can do just 5 or 10 minutes of exercise, that's better than doing nothing, and you can gradually increase how much you exercise. In fact, doing too much too soon can cause fatigue, soreness, and injury, and may not necessarily yield instant results, all of which could discourage you from exercising altogether. Make a plan. It's easy and not particularly productive to say to yourself, "I really should exercise." To make it happen, you really need a specific plan. What kind of activity will you do? How much will you do? When will you start? Walking is a good place to begin because most people do it and are used to it. You can start off planning to walk a certain distance, like walking several blocks or just taking one spin around the block. Once you've done that, you can gradually increase your distance and perhaps consider picking up the pace by jogging or running. In the beginning, it's helpful to have both short-term and long-term goals. A short-term goal might be to be more active, and a long-term goal might be to participate in a 5-kilometer race, shed X number of pounds, or get your blood pressure under control. Some people find it helpful to write down these goals. Make it a habit. For exercise to be completely effective, you have to stick with it over the long run. There are ways to reinforce the exercise habit. First of all, try to make sure you exercise every day or at least several times a week. It helps if you schedule it at the same time every day, such as right before or after work. If you don't feel that energetic, just be sure to do something at the appointed time, even if it's a fraction of what you usually do. And once you get going, you may surprise yourself. Another consideration, obvious but often overlooked, is to do something you enjoy. Do you enjoy nature? Find nice wooded areas in which to bike, jog, or hike. Do you like being around people? Consider a group exercise class, like aerobics, Zumba, cardio kickboxing, or yoga. Or exercise regularly with a friend, which will also help keep you both committed. Do you enjoy competitive sports? Try tennis, basketball, golf, volleyball, softball, or bowling. Stay safe when you exercise. There are a few steps you should take to guarantee your safety when exercising. It's very easy to become dehydrated when you exercise, especially if you're working out for long periods, so be sure to drink plenty of fluids before, during, and after periods of physical activity. Staying hydrated can also help your body recover from exercise. If you're prone to hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, always be sure to carry treatment, such as glucose tabs or gel, or a fast-acting carbohydrate like fruit juice or regular, not diet, soda. Before your workout, do something to warm up. It will increase your performance and minimize the risk of injury. For example, before you run or jog, walk for a period of 5 to 10 minutes. A few minutes of cooling down can help your body, especially your heart rate, return to normal. After running or jogging, for example, walking for a few minutes can get your heart rate back in the normal range. After strength training, doing a few minutes of stretching exercises can help keep your muscles from getting tight and sore. Remember, the key to regular exercise is just taking that first step. What is HIIT and should I do it? High intensity interval training HIIT, is all the rage in gyms and health clubs. But you may be wondering exactly what it is, what its specific benefits are, and whether it is safe and advisable for people with diabetes. HIIT involves short bouts, about 30 seconds, of high-intensity aerobic exercise, such as jumping jacks, squats, or burpees, alternating with equally short periods of rest, for a total duration of under half an hour. Research shows that HIIT has basically the same benefits as moderate-intensity exercise, such as brisk walking or leisurely swimming or biking, in terms of weight loss, blood cholesterol levels, cardiorespiratory disease, and the overall risk of cardiovascular disease. Yet, HIIT can offer these benefits in less time, which could make it an attractive option for people who have difficulty fitting exercise into their schedule. However, HIIT may pose a greater risk to people with health conditions. If you have heart disease, for example, you should speak with your healthcare team before starting HIIT or any exercise program for that matter. Also, most HIIT workouts are high impact, which may make them less than ideal for people with arthritic conditions, although some gyms offer HIIT classes that are specifically low impact. What is functional fitness? Functional fitness involves physical training that helps us carry out the activities of everyday life, such as getting in and out of chairs and carrying out household activities, such as vacuuming, mowing the lawn, and raking leaves. Functional fitness exercises, each of which requires that multiple muscle groups be used together, include lunges, squats, push-ups, and twists. The four components of total fitness. Ideally, any exercise routine should address the four basic components of fitness: cardiovascular activity, strength, flexibility, and balance. Cardiovascular activity. Cardiovascular activity refers to activity that raises your heart rate, and it's important for losing weight and keeping your heart healthy. Some excellent forms of cardiovascular activity include walking, hiking, jogging, running, biking, and swimming. To reap the benefits, you should shoot for at least 20 to 30 minutes at least four times a week. Strength. Strength training has a number of benefits. Being strong helps us stay active and independent. For people with diabetes, building muscle helps burn calories, aiding in weight loss, and it increases the body's glucose uptake, helping to keep blood glucose levels in the normal range. When you are starting out, experts recommend exercises that use your own body weight, which are safer and easier than some other types of strength training. Body weight exercises include push-ups, sit-ups, planks, squats, and lunges. Once you've become a little stronger, you can start to add more resistance, such as free weights, barbells and dumbbells, or elastic bands. You can ease into it even more gradually by choosing light weights or highly flexible elastic bands. To be effective, you should engage in strength training at least twice a week, but avoid using the same muscle groups 2 days in a row in order to give your muscles time to recover. Flexibility. Flexibility is one of the most underrated forms of fitness, yet it's important for preventing injuries and essential to staying active and independent. Most yoga classes emphasize flexibility, but there are also simple stretches, such as flexing your ankles while you're sitting down, that can make life a little easier. Balance. Balance is important for many sports, including biking and skiing, but it also becomes very important as we age, helping us to avoid falls. Yoga, as well as the moving meditation of Tai Chi or Qigong, can help improve balance. For those just starting out, there are a couple of simple balance exercises to start you on your way. One is to balance on one leg and then the other, maybe with the help of the back of a chair to hold. Another great balance exercise is to practice walking across the room, heel to toe. Processed diets might promote chronic infections that can lead to disorders such as diabetes. Source, Georgia State University. Processed diets, which are low in fiber, may initially reduce the incidence of foodborne infectious diseases such as E. coli infections, but might also increase the incidence of diseases characterized by low-grade chronic infection and inflammation such as diabetes, according to researchers in the Institute for Biomedical Sciences at Georgia State University. This study used mice to investigate how changing from a grain-based diet to a highly processed, high-fat Western-style diet impacts infection with the pathogen Citrobacter rodentium, which resembles Escherichia coli, E. coli infections in humans. The findings are published in the journal PLOS Pathogens. Gut microbiota, the microorganisms living in the intestine, provide a number of benefits, such as protecting a host from infection by bacterial pathogens. These microorganisms are influenced by a variety of environmental factors, especially diet, and rely heavily on complex carbohydrates, such as fiber. The Western-style diet, which contains high amounts of processed foods, red meat, high-fat dairy products, high-sugar foods, and prepackaged foods, lacks fiber, which is needed to support gut microbiota. Changes in dietary habits, especially a lack of fiber, are believed to have contributed to increased prevalence of chronic inflammatory diseases, such as inflammatory bowel disease, metabolic syndrome, and cancer. In this study, the researchers found switching mice from a standard grain-based rodent chow to a high-fat, low-fiber, Western-style diet resulted in a rapid reduction in the number of gut bacteria. Mice fed the Western-style diet were frequently unable to clear the pathogen Citrobacter rodentium from the colon. They were also prone to developing chronic infection when re-challenged by this pathogen. The researchers conclude the Western-style diet reduces the numbers of gut bacteria and promotes encroachment of microbiota into the intestine, potentially influencing immune system readiness and the body's defense against pathogenic bacteria. We observe that feeding mice a Western-style diet rather than standard rodent grain-based chow altered the dynamics of Citrobacter infection, reducing initial colonization and inflammation, which was surprising. However, mice consuming the Western-style diet frequently developed persistent infection that was associated with low-grade inflammation and insulin resistance, said Dr. Andrew Gewirtz, senior co-author of the study and professor in the Institute for Biomedical Sciences. These studies demonstrate potential of altering microbiota and their metabolites by diet to impact the course and consequence of infection following exposure to a gut pathogen. We speculate that reshaping gut microbiota by nutrients that promote beneficial bacteria that outcompete pathogens may be a means of broadly promoting health, said Dr. Jun Zhu, senior co-author of the study and assistant professor in the Institute for Biomedical Sciences at Georgia State University. Taking Steps Toward Healthy Feet by Kurt Ullman, RN. Foot care is an important part of managing your diabetes. In fact, keeping an eye on your feet can help prevent major problems, including amputation. In the diabetic patient, there are many complications involving the lower limbs, says Diane Koshimune, DPM, a podiatrist at Kaiser Permanente in California. The feet are important in our day-to-day lives. If something happens to them, it can impact your ability to walk, to get around, to work. Nerve damage causes complications. Poorly controlled diabetes can cause a number of complications. One of the main concerns is nerve damage to the feet, a condition called diabetic peripheral neuropathy, DPN. It is estimated that around 50% of people with type 2 diabetes and 20% of those with type 1 diabetes will develop DPN. Depending on which nerves are affected, this can be either very painful or rob you of sensation in your feet. If it impacts the small nerves, then signals to your brain about pain and temperature can be disrupted. Attacking the larger nerves can result in not being able to detect pressure and touch or maintain balance. If you have DPN, you are most likely to have a mixture of both issues. Because of nerve damage, people can't feel their feet, says Robert Gabay, MD, PhD, Chief Scientific and Medical Officer for the American Diabetes Association, ADA. The result is that minor problems that occur from too much pressure or ill-fitting shoes don't result in a signal that something is wrong. So instead of the person readjusting their shoes or getting out a pebble, the injury continues, leading to calluses and ultimately an ulcer. The most commonly described symptoms of DPN are a sensation of numbness, a pins and needles tingling, and weakness in the affected area of the body. Some may experience a sharp, what is called lightning-like pain. Others may have a more burning, throbbing, or stabbing pain. Causes not well understood. How diabetes harms these nerve cells is still not well understood. Poor control of blood sugar levels is almost certainly one of the causes. Emerging research suggests that there are other contributors as well. Obesity and high triglycerides, a type of blood fat, may double the risk. Smoking may increase the risk of DPN by 42%. High blood pressure has been found to up the likelihood of nerve damage from 11% to 65%. Low levels of good cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein, HDL, and high readings of bad cholesterol, low-density lipoprotein, LDL, boost risk by up to 67%. While cuts and infections are important, you can also have poor outcomes from broken bones that you do not feel, notes Dr. Kashimian. Your leg or foot may be a little swollen, but since you feel no pain, you go about your normal day. You finally realize that something is wrong when your foot begins to change shape. Peripheral vascular disease. Another common foot complication in diabetes is peripheral vascular disease, PVD. In this case, the flow of blood through your feet and legs is lessened because of fat deposits that narrow or block the arteries. Blood flow issues from damage to the cardiovascular system can also have devastating results, says Dr. Gabay. This makes you more prone to infection and also can impede healing. Signs and symptoms. Many people, especially at earlier stages of PVD, may have no symptoms, or they may have severe muscle pain that goes away with rest. Called claudication, this pain is usually triggered by very moderate exercise, such as walking or going upstairs. As it worsens, they may get severe pains even when sitting or lying down. Some of the other signs and symptoms can mimic DPN, such as leg numbness or weakness. PVD may also be seen as coldness in your lower leg or foot, especially when compared with the other leg or foot, sores on your toes, feet, or legs that won't heal, color changes in the legs, hair loss or slowed hair growth, shiny skin, slowed growth of your toenails, and no or weak pulses in your legs and feet. Men may also have problems with erectile dysfunction. DPN and PVD are often found together, compounding the risk for serious outcomes such as infection that spreads to the bloodstream, called sepsis, or into the bones, leading to amputation. Lack of sensation in your lower extremities can be very dangerous, resulting in not finding injuries such as blisters from your shoes or cuts from walking barefoot. In addition, when the blood supply is compromised by PVD, nutrients may not get to where they are needed. White blood cells and other components that fight infection and help promote healing are not able to reach the infection, resulting in it worsening. Daily actions to improve foot health. Foot care is an important part of keeping your lower limbs in good health. Here are some steps you can take each day to help avoid serious complications. Inspect your feet carefully, looking for signs of damage such as small cuts, scrapes, infected toenails, blisters, or calluses. Wash your feet with warm but not hot water and make sure you dry them off completely to avoid having warm and wet spots for fungus to grow. Use your elbow to test the water temperature before washing your feet. Keep the tops and bottoms of your feet moisturized, but not between the toes, as this may increase the chances of a fungal infection. Don't go barefoot, as this increases the possibility of injury and infection. Quit smoking, as this habit decreases blood flow to the feet. Take daily walks, which can help increase blood flow. If you are trimming your toenails, trim straight across and don't round off the corners or cut down the sides of the nail. Smooth them with a nail file. Wear appropriate, well-fitting shoes to avoid blistering. A professional measurement can help you find the best fit. Keep an eye on your feet to check for areas where your shoes may be consistently rubbing and breaking down the skin. If your diabetes or age have impacted your vision, ask a family member to examine the bottoms of your feet and between your toes thoroughly. You also may want to use a mirror to look at the undersides of your feet. Some mirrors specially designed for foot inspection have telescoping handles, magnifying surfaces, and lights. Glucose control also important. The best way to prevent problems with your feet is to work closely with your primary care physician or diabetes specialist in managing blood sugar control, says Dr. Koshimun. The better the control, the better your chances of proper healing or at least limited damage. With poor control, the lack of healing can lead to multiple surgeries needed to close up the skin or remove the infection. Many people are able to manage their foot care by themselves. However, if you are losing feeling, you will need to stay in closer contact with your personal physicians and/or a podiatrist. Risk groups. People with diabetes can be divided into two groups based on their risk of foot complications. A simple test helps differentiate between the two groups. The monofilament test uses a small, thin wire to apply pressure to various places along your legs and feet. If you don't feel it, your risk is increased. If you also have reduced blood flow or a foot deformity, you are in an even higher risk group. Those at greatest risk may be advised not to trim their own toenails and to see a podiatrist more often. Once upon a time, we used to say that everyone should absolutely see a podiatrist, but now we work in a team environment, said Dr. Koshimun. If you have neuropathy, you should be seen every year or so, but foot evaluations are typically managed by your primary care provider. For those who have other concerns, such as vascular disease or bone malformations, you should have an appointment every 90 days. Those with a previous ulcer or surgery may be seen more frequently. Calluses or blisters should be seen right away. Work with your healthcare team or on self-care. Follow your healthcare team's lead on what foot care you can or cannot do yourself. Depending on your situation, certain measures, such as trimming your toenails, may be best taken care of by your podiatrist. If you want to take charge of your own health care, advocate for yourself and ask to see specialists if you think they are needed and available in your area, said Dr. Koshimun. Unfortunately, there isn't a pill for everything, but there are things you can do to lead a normal life. Uncovering basic mechanisms of intestinal stem cell self-renewal and differentiation by Mayer L. et al. The gut plays a central role in the regulation of the body's metabolism, and its dysfunction is associated with a variety of diseases such as obesity, diabetes, colitis, and colorectal cancer that affects millions of people worldwide. Targeting endocrine dysfunction at an early stage by stimulating the formation of specific enteroendocrine cells from intestinal stem cells could be a promising regenerative approach for diabetes therapy. For this, however, a detailed understanding of the intestinal stem cell lineage hierarchy and the signals regulating the recruitment of the different intestinal cell types is critical. Heiko Lickert and his research group have taken up this challenge. Lickert is director of the Institute of Diabetes and Regeneration Research at Helmholtz Zentrum München, professor of beta cell biology at Technical University of Munich, TUM, and member of the German Center for Diabetes Research, DZD. In the following, Lickert and first author Annika Botcher talk about their latest paper on the basic mechanisms of intestinal stem cell function published in Nature Cell Biology. Why is the gut so important for health research? Heiko Lickert, as the body's digestive and large endocrine system, the gut is central to the regulation of energy and glucose homeostasis. Intestinal functions are carried out by specialized cells, which are constantly generated and renewed every 3 to 4 days from intestinal stem cells. For example, so-called enteroendocrine cells produce over 20 different types of hormones that signal to the brain and pancreas to regulate, for instance, appetite, food intake, gastric emptying, and insulin secretion from pancreatic beta cells. Another important gut function is exerted by so-called Paneth cells that produce defense and protect against invading pathogens. Consequently, it is not surprising that intestinal dysfunction is associated with a variety of diseases, such as chronic inflammation, colorectal cancer, and diabetes, affecting millions of people worldwide. What are the most important findings in your latest research about intestinal stem cells? Annika Botcher, we improved our understanding of how intestinal stem cells constantly renew and give rise to specialized cell types at unprecedented single-cell resolution. Thus, we are now able to describe potential progenitor populations for each intestinal cell, and we have shown that for every lineage, intestinal stem cells give rise to unipotent lineage progenitors. Furthermore, we identified a specific intestinal stem cell niche signal pathway called WNT, planar cell polarity pathway, regulating intestinal stem cell self-renewal and lineage decisions. This is very important as we know that intestinal stem cells can infinitely renew and maintain the gut function and tissue barrier. Those are 6 meters of epithelium and more than 100 million of cells generated every day in humans. Moreover, these cells differentiate into every single cell type. The risk of failure in this self-renewal or lineage specification process to result in a chronic disease, therefore, is quite high. How can this new knowledge be translated to therapeutic approaches? Heiko Lickert, this study challenges current paradigms, and we advanced our understanding of intestinal stem cell self-renewal, heterogeneity, and lineage recruitment. We can use this basic knowledge to map what happens to intestinal stem cell lineage allocation and differentiation during chronic disease. Insights from this will put us in place to develop specific therapies for these diseases by targeting lineage progenitors, for example, to regenerate the formation of specific cells that are lost during disease progression, or to identify and eradicate intestinal cancer stem cells. Specifically, at our institute, we will focus our efforts on diabetes. This is Barbara Foster reading about diabetes.